are made possible in part by Kranich Center for the Performing Arts, where Summer Studio Theater Company productions begin June 16th. Information about the summer studio presentations of My Three Angels, Last of the Red Hot Lovers, and Broadway can be obtained from the Kranich Center ticket office at 800-KCPA-TIX, 800-527-2849, or on the web at kranichcenter.com.
Susan and Lou Hopkins bet there are a number of you who believe WILL's worth at least 28 cents a day, but for some reason you still have never contributed. So to help you make the move, they'll add $10 to your contribution. If the information you get from WILL's worth at least 28 cents a day, call 217-244-9455. Contribute $100 or more, and the Hopkins will add 10 as their way of saying thanks for becoming a new friend of WILL Urbana. We thank you, too.
This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL AM 580 and online at WILL.UIUC.edu. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Thanks for tuning in today. Our guest this afternoon is writer Roxana Robinson. Her latest book, A Perfect Stranger, is a collection of short stories. It follows the publication of her novel, Sweetwater, which is now available in paperback. Roxana Robinson is the author of three novels, three collections of short stories, and a biography of Georgia O'Keeffe. Her books have won a great deal of acclaim. Let me mention a couple of the honors. She's been named a Literary Lion by the New York Public Library. Her biography of Georgia O'Keeffe was nominated for the National Book Critics Circle Award. By my count, four of her books have been chosen New York Times Notable Books of the Year. This week, the book reviewer for All Things Considered, Alan Chews, recommended listeners put A Perfect Stranger on their summer reading lists. Last month, the New York Times Book Review had high praise for Robinson and A Perfect Stranger. Reviewer Bliss Broyard, also a writer of short fiction, said Robinson is particularly good at charting the ebb and flow of affection and fury within relationships. Listeners, I welcome your questions and comments this afternoon for our guest, Roxana Robinson. Join us with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, call toll-free, 800-222-9455. 800-222-WILL. Roxana Robinson, thanks so much for joining me this afternoon.
Thank you so much for inviting me.
Oh, my pleasure. In the biographical information that came with A Perfect Stranger, you say a perfect short story is like a perfect curve. And I think that is absolutely right on the money. But I also think that short stories get short shrift.
Yeah, they do. It's interesting. A friend of mine was saying that maybe it's because they take short stories, even though they're shorter than novels, may take more attention to read than novels. And people feel that they need to focus more carefully. But I do think they get short shrift. I think the short story, I love writing in the short story form. It's very demanding, but it's wonderful. It's very exhilarating to write a short story. I also think maybe people felt disenchanted by short stories after a time when they started seeming so minimalist that it was hard to figure out what was there. And that's something that I think, as a writer, I think that I owe my reader a real dramatic shift, a real dramatic event, a real narrative. I think a story should deliver that. It should engage you, it should make you think, and it should make you realize that something has been altered since the beginning.
Yeah. Well, with the short stories in this collection, you have me holding my breath, you know, with that feel of back and forth and narrative, and I am just pulled through the stories. Maybe we could talk about the title story, for example, A Perfect Stranger. It's a story about marriage and love. What would you like to say about the story?
A perfect stranger is the perfect stranger in the story is an Englishman who's an opera expert who comes to spend the weekend with a suburban couple who have invited him because the woman is on the board of the local music center. So she's been sort of chosen to be his hostess, but they don't know each other. They've barely met. And so there are three strangers spending the weekend together in an old farmhouse out in the country, and it's about the tensions that are produced by this. Her husband wasn't really very happy to have him come, and so she's sort of struggling in this silent tussle with her husband all weekend. She doesn't want to have an argument because she's afraid the guest will overhear. And the guest, who loves Americans and is very happy to be there, but there are all kinds of cultural signals that are different between English and American eyes. So starting with the spelling of her husband's name, which is Jeffrey, which is spelled differently in English mm-hmm. and in American, and his thinking about dirt roads and clapboard houses, everything that he perceives in a slightly different way from the way she perceives it. So it's about that. It's about cultural differences. It's about marriage. It's about notions of hospitality and anxiety. But it also is about meditation and sort of the deeper place that we live, not the place on the surface where our anxieties mm-hmm. lie, but the more central parts of our lives where we make the deepest connections.
Yeah. Martha's eagerness to please is palpable. She wants it all to be okay, and I suppose I'm a little like Martha. I want it to be that way, too. But, you know, it's interesting. She's trying to please everyone but herself and her husband.
Well, yes, I mean, you're a hostess, too. you're my hostess right now. I think anybody who takes on that role, who says, yes, I'll welcome you into this particular space, feels an obligation. And I certainly know that feeling, that you want things to go well. And that's the way you feel, oh, when your family comes home for Thanksgiving, or you show up at somebody's dinner party. I mean, somebody is trying to make everything go right. And in this story, things are not going to go right. They go pretty strangely wrong. And Martha just feels this burden get heavier and heavier.
Yeah. One of the delights of this story is the first impressions the narrators have of one another. We have a point of view shifting back and forth between Martha Truesdale and Michael Kingsley, the guest who's in the house for the weekend. When you're writing, do you enjoy introducing the characters to one another?
Well, in this story, it was lots of fun because their points of view were so different.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things that I do enjoy about writing is taking on other people's lives, is becoming engaged by somebody else's point of view. And in that way, a writer has sort of the same task as an actor. You're meant to become somebody else. You impersonate somebody else. And so moving back and forth between Martha and Mr. Kingsley was enormously fun for me.
Yeah. You know, that shift in point of view back and forth, it was fun, you say, but I also imagine it was challenging to leave one person aside and step into the shoes of the other back and forth.
I can't tell you, I can't explain to you how that happens. It just does. It wasn't any more challenging than moving into Martha's mind in the beginning. It's just something that once you start the writing process and become engaged by it, those shifts happen in some odd way. So it's not a challenge. I had to make sure that I got all the details right, that I wasn't saying something that would be idiotic for a 71-year-old Englishman to be saying. But it had no more challenge than writing it in the first person of just a single narrator would have been.
Hmm. How did that story first begin to take shape in your imagination?
Well, something similar happened to me, I have to say. And I won't give away the ending to the readers, but there's a sort of a comical mistake that occurs towards the end of the story, and that mistake, that moment, happened to me, and I just thought it was so rich and so fabulous and so complicated that I had to address it in fiction.
Yeah. We all have those moments, don't we, where we're suddenly there and stuck and suddenly you begin to feel yourself just perspire.
You're stuck, that's the thing. Yeah. We all get stuck in these moments. And afterwards you look back and you think, okay, that would have been so simple if I had just done such and such, if I'd just done X. But you can't do X at the time. You just can't.
Yeah.
So you muddle through in some ridiculous way.
Yeah. You've cut off the flow, so to speak, and you're stuck.
Mm.
Rather than going with the flow and just letting it go, you can't let go. So is character where you begin?
Yes. I actually have two ways of writing, and one is the way I write short stories is quite different from the way I write novels. With a short story, I start with incident rather than character. I start with a moment, like the moment in A Perfect Stranger, this ridiculous mistake that takes place. And in all of the stories, you'll find the moment, the moment that's dramatic and powerful. And it's usually an incident that I've heard about or that I experienced myself or that I've witnessed and stays with me. And I think this moment is just needs to be explored. I have to go into it more. So when I write a short story, I have the moment in my mind, and I'm writing towards that moment. And my job as the writer is to have you, the reader, reach that moment in a state of understanding and awareness. So you need to know the characters as well as you need, as well as necessary, in order for that moment to be as powerful for you as it was for me. So the short story really starts with an incident, and then I create the characters, or the characters cluster around that incident to make it occur. When I write a novel, I start out with a group of characters and a conflict, a problem. And I get to know the characters very well. I write little biographies of each one of them, actually, so I know exactly who they are, what their backgrounds are, and what their character is. So it's the character that will determine their behavior throughout the rest of the book. So then that everything is set in motion by this conflict, and then the characters act out the plot. They deliver the story themselves.
Is the dramatic moment a subset of conflict?
Yes, absolutely. Conflict is what creates drama, unless you're dealing with a purely physical event, you know, like an earthquake or something, but then it's still the character that determines how people respond to it. So character, for me, is the main thing.
Yeah. And you've got the characters then, and with the novel, you've written the little biographies of everybody who's on the stage. Do you have an idea of the action that is going to ensue at the outset at that point?
I know some things. I know what direction things will go in. I understand. I mean, if there's a problem, if somebody's uncertain about her marriage, you know, I know we're going to get into trouble. There's no point in writing a whole novel about someone who's uncertain about her marriage but decides to stay with her husband. So things are going to get very difficult and complicated and bad. How they turn out in the end, I don't usually know. I have a sense of the direction we're going into, but I don't know exactly how things will turn out. So there's a lot I don't know about the plot.
Mm. Back to the short stories in A Perfect Stranger. Would you tell us about the story, Assistance?
Mm. Well, Assistance is about a woman who goes down to stay with her parents, who are living alone, and they're elderly. And they're in a state of mind which is pretty much fine and functioning, but they're also starting to become a little spacey. So when she stays with them, she sort of drifts in and out of this state that they're in, trying to connect with them, trying to love them, trying to help them in any way she can, but they don't think they need any help, and they resent her attempts. And she doesn't, and then they don't exactly need any help, so she feels frustrated and kind of useless, but they do need help, so it's, again, it's this kind of complicated, half ludicrous and half touching.
Yeah, do we laugh or do we cry?
Yeah, it's hard to know which to do. So it's complex.
Yeah. Well, I think Adele could use a little assistance too.
She's alone. She lives alone, and she doesn't really know how to deal with this.
Yeah. The room where she stays in the house. Do you have the book with you?
I don't, but I...
Okay. Remember. I do.
Yeah.
The room where she stays, it's kind of a mix of styles and furnishings. And there she is, and she's unable to sleep. And it says, from 2:15 until 4:30, Adele lay awake, reading in the blonde wood contemporary bed her uncle had given her mother when he got rid of all his Swedish modern in the 1970s. The austere bed looked out of place. The room had lavender walls and white ruffled curtains and was full of dark Victorian furniture from Adele's grandparents. The mahogany sleigh bed had gone to Adele's older sister in San Diego when the Swedish bed arrived. Adele's mother draped a length of thin lavender cloth over the wooden headboard in an effort to make the new bed blend with the room. It was unsuccessful. The angular blonde wood bed with its loose lavender hood looked merely bizarre, as though it had been set there among the ruffles and mahogany according to some alternate universe theory of decoration inaccessible to us. How did you create that room?
Oh, when I start in on these characters, their surroundings are very visual. I'm a very visual writer. Their surroundings become very visually explicit. And when I write a novel, for example, when I wrote Sweetwater, I drew designs of the houses so that I would know exactly where people were walking, what the kitchen looked like. So in this, when I came to know these parents, their background and their room became very vivid to me.
Yeah. It also strikes me as a metaphor, perhaps, for all that comes and goes in our lives.
Absolutely. I mean, everything that room, everything that's described in that room has to do with the family and the shifts that take place in the family. So she's inhabiting a space that is constantly, as you say, in flux because of the way the family moves.
This is at the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon, writer Roxana Robinson. Her latest book, A Perfect Stranger, is a collection of short stories. It follows the publication of her novel, Sweetwater, which is now available in paperback. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, I welcome your questions and comments for our guest, Roxana Robinson. You can join the conversation with a telephone call. 333-9455 is the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free. 800-222-9455. 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL. You mentioned that you're a visual writer, and I know that you have studied and written about art. Do you see connections between these two parts of your life?
I suppose I should, yes. I mean, art is something that's very much a part of my life. It's very important to me. I started to work I took art history classes in college, and I worked at Sotheby's for a number of years in the American Painting Department. So art has always been very important to me, both for visual reasons and for philosophical reasons. I was very interested in the way art had such strong connections to the philosophy of a period or the economics of a period. So it seems like a very central thing in my life. Writing the biography of Georgia O'Keeffe was wonderful to me because it allowed me to write about art, which I very much enjoy doing, and to see what a part that played in her life and in the development of American art in the 20th century. And also to describe paintings, it's a wonderful exercise. And also, since Georgia O'Keeffe herself is a wonderful character, a great person to write about, and her life was fascinating. So it was almost like being asked to write a novel, having the plot and the characters delivered to you. So it was a great treat, that project.
Yeah. I know you also write essays, but it seems to me you're very much a writer of fiction. So that's interesting that Georgia O'Keeffe allowed you a way to write a biography that was novel-like.
It felt that way. I mean, not that I made things up. I didn't.
No.
But it was this wonderful narrative and characters that were given to me.
Yeah. When did you begin writing fiction?
Probably in first grade. I wrote stories. I made up stories as early as I can remember. I wrote short stories in high school, and I studied in college with Bernard Malamud, and never stopped, really.
Yeah. Have they always been character-driven,
the stories? Well, before I really understood the process, I think they were emotion-driven. I think I wrote about just feelings that troubled me that I thought needed exploration, things I had to understand. I really write, as many writers do, to understand things. So if there's something that troubles me that I can't figure out, that I feel blocked about, I'll write about it.
Yeah. Well, characters and the intimacies of them, their interactions, the puzzles of them, that's also about emotion, isn't it?
And the reason it's a good beginning it's a good way to start if you've got characters in a conflict. Characters will just go about their merry ways unless there's a problem, and then they have to start dealing with it, and that's when the conflict ensues, and then people reveal themselves, and they act in ways they wish they hadn't, or in more dramatic ways, in more powerful and devastating and troubling ways. So it becomes a real story instead of just an anecdote.
Yeah. The dramatic moment in The Facelift, maybe this is an appropriate point to talk about that short story. What lies beneath that story? What has happened?
Well, that's a really interesting one. Again, not to give away what happens, but it's about two women who were roommates in boarding school, and one is from Latin America. She's from El Salvador. The other one is from Pennsylvania, and they have very, very different lives and different backgrounds. The one from Pennsylvania is very quiet and leads a very decorous life. She is divorced, has no children. And the one from El Salvador is very beautiful, very glamorous, very rich, and has always seemed to do just what she wanted, and now she's about to get a facelift. And it's about many things, but it's about, one of the things it's about is women's friendship, which I think is a really interesting subject. I think women's friendship seems more complicated and more demanding than men's friendship. Men seem to give each other a nice kind of peaceful, often silent, unexamined support. And I don't mean to diminish it, and it means a lot, and it does a lot, but women are more demanding, and they tell each other more, and they ask each other more, and there's more complexity to it, which means they often frustrate and disappoint each other. And there's some qualities in it of erotic love, romantic love. It's kind of women fall in love with each other and then disappoint each other, let each other down, and then abandon each other and feel hurt and wounded and upset. They have much more dramatic friendships than men seem to. So I wanted to write about that, and this woman who loves her friend, but also there's a strain of envy and jealousy in her love for her friend. And then also there's this very dramatic event that takes place in San Salvador, which is true, as a matter of fact, in which a man tries to hijack a car full of women. And again, as I say, I'm very visual. I was very struck by this incident, which was told to me by a friend, and the way it was played out. And we can all imagine that as being part of a movie. It seemed very cinematic. The women, the chauffeur in the hot still afternoon, the high walls, the silent streets, the man with a gun, these women with jewelry and necklaces and bracelets and beautiful silk dresses, and this violence entering into the scene. And it's a movie we've all seen, and there's a beautiful young girl, and she gets grabbed by the gunman and dragged into the car. And we all know what's going to happen next. We all know about the high-speed chase and the gunshots and the police, and there's certainly going to be some blood in this movie. There's going to be pain and terror, maybe death. It's going to be something, you know, my stomach seizes up when I think about it. I don't mm-hmm. want to watch it. I don't want to have to watch this girl go through what she has to go through. And then what happens is it's a very different ending, and it's an ending that's not written by men. It's written by women. And they use a completely different set of strategies to change the ending of this thing that we know very well, this horrible event that we recognize. And they do things, and they use completely different weapons. They use embarrassment and humiliation and surprise to make things come out very differently. So I loved that. I loved the notion that there could be a completely different ending to a story that we thought we knew very well.
Yeah. It also struck me very much that it is a story about what can happen one moment to the next, and you really, truly just don't know.
Yes, it's terrifying, and we've all been in moments where you suddenly think, oh, God, if only I had put the brakes on a minute ago, or if only I hadn't picked up the phone, and you keep sort of frantically trying to rewind and go back to that moment before this all started to happen.
Yeah, just a moment ago I was.
Yeah.
And then life will go on no matter what happens.
Yeah.
You know, moment to moment.
Yeah, it's we're always out of control. We think we're in control, but we're not. Something can happen that you didn't expect, and then things may turn out all right, and they may not.
Yeah. Among your short stories, do you have favorites?
I really don't. People ask me that all the time. They're so different, my stories, and I'm trying to do something different in each one so that, you know, the story about Family Christmas is my favorite story, in which I deal with three generations and a little girl who's struggling to understand what adult behavior really means. That's my favorite story about that. The Facelift is my favorite story about women's friendship and violence. So, you know, each story is a completely different puzzle for me that I've solved in this particular way. But there isn't one story that I say that's the best set of circumstances, those are the best characters, I'm happiest with the way it turned out.
Yeah. And I would imagine the same would go for your novels.
Yeah, really. They seem so different to me. Each one is a completely different set of problems, and they're solved differently. I'm very fond of all of them. I loved writing them, and I love feeling that they exist. But I don't have favorites.
What inspired Sweetwater?
Well, Sweetwater, it's strange. In fact, this has never happened to me before, but it started out with an image. I had this picture in my mind of a woman in her 40s who was walking along a wooden dock at the edge of a lake, and beyond the lake were wooded mountains and a summer sky, and in the foreground was a shingled boathouse. And the woman was walking along the dock, and you know how docks are made in sections with different pilings, so each section is slightly at a different level from the other one before. And this woman is in the process of stepping from one level to the other, one piece of the dock to another. And that was it. That was all I knew when I first started that book. And as I began exploring it, I learned in some the way that you learn about what you're writing about, that the lake and the mountains were in the Adirondacks, that the woman was there visiting her second husband at his family's place, and that she gives her whole life to the environment. She's an environmentalist, and her specialty is water, specifically groundwater. But so for her, the Adirondacks have a kind of a double presence. she sees them as the beautiful place to take a vacation in, but she also sees them as part of a wonderful system that we all sort of take for granted, the way water works in our environments, the beautiful system of natural hydrology, the way rain and groundwater and springs and lakes and streams all function for us. So it was a very rich and complex beginning.
Yeah. Now, where is there life without water?
It is more important than light to life. So I fell in love with water while I was writing that book. I did a lot of reading about it and just became enamored of the beautiful way that it functions.
Yeah. How can it... It would seem to me you have to have water and light.
Apparently not. There's life, I guess, that exists at the bottom of the ocean where there's no light.
Of course.
But the opposite is not true. There's nowhere. But I suppose there's... I mean, I read that statement, so I say it, but I suppose there's no place on Earth that has no water, so it would be hard to define. But anyway, that is sort of a scientific declaration that has been the result of research. So, but it's so beautiful, water, and when you start thinking of it, the way streams, the way rainwater falls onto soft earth and sinks down and becomes into the aquifer and then bubbles up into springs of fresh well water, and then the streams become larger creeks and they carry off debris and clean themselves, clean the streams, and then carry the rich earth from along the riverbanks in the flood to the deltas. The deltas become breeding grounds for waterfowl and rich swamplands. It's just every aspect of it is a kind of natural beauty. And everything that you think about water, I mean, every aspect of the landscape that's touched by water is something that is necessary to us in a beautiful, deep, powerful, instinctive way.
Yeah. It's interesting, you know, of all the environmental issues that are out there, this one is the one that resonates most with my mother. Water.
Really?
She's just passionate about you cannot foul the water or you will be in really big trouble.
Yeah, yeah. It's serious. It's really serious.
Yeah.
Once groundwater is contaminated, it's nearly impossible to eliminate it. It seeps. Water seeps forever. And we're draining aquifers, and we're contaminating rainwater, and we're contaminating streams. We're doing a lot of damage.
Well, what role does water play in this novel, Sweetwater?
It's an even simpler and more sort of invisible one that we're all aware of. There's a terrible drought. So Isabel, the character, is very aware of what drought does to the forest and what the risks are of drought. Severe droughts can destroy civilizations. There was a civilization apparently in the Middle East about 4,000 years ago that was completely destroyed by 3 years of absolute drought. Even the earthworms died in the soil. There was nothing. And that was obviously a civilization that was dependent on its own production of agricultural materials. So without rain for 3 years, there was nothing left. But in our own landscapes, we have other alternatives, but we can't really control these larger climatic changes. And if drought sweeps across the landscape for too long, which it's doing increasingly, there are things that we can't control.
How did your passion for the environment begin?
It's sort of like the way I started writing. I grew up in the country, and I spent a lot of time outside. I had a dog, and I spent a lot of time with him. And then I was allowed to have a horse, and I spent a lot of time on her back. So watching the natural world has just been part of my life from as early as I can remember. And I've watched the land around my parents' house be developed. It was all farmland when I was little, and now it's all houses. And I've watched the climate change. I'm also a gardener. And since I began gardening, say 20 years, I've watched things change. I've watched trees, the whole the ash trees where we used to have a house in Westchester are now subject to a kind of something called dieback, which attacks them and just lays them low. But that has to do with climate change, because I've watched, we all know what happens. In January, suddenly there will be a day that's 70 degrees, which may seem pleasant in the middle of the winter, but what that means is all the plants, which are hibernating for the winter, are given this signal that spring is here. Mm-hmm. So that means they have to start sending their energy upward. For a tree, it means sending the sap up from the roots up through the trunk up towards the tips. If we get 5 days in a row of 70-degree weather, that's a lot of effort that the tree puts out. And then if the next day it's 20 degrees, which happens now, that's a terrible blow to the tree, and it has to retract all its energy and send everything back down. If that happens periodically all winter long, then it puts out leaves in whenever it puts them out, March, say, and then those leaves get nipped by frost. All these things that happen now that we have such erratic weather patterns put terrible strain on all the green plants that have evolved. Every plant on Earth has evolved in response to some set of reliable weather patterns, whether it's dry all the time or a temperate climate or cold all the time. It's pretty reliable. There are erratic moments, but in general, weather has been pretty reliable for hundreds of thousands of years. Of course, we get huge shifts like ice ages, but for the last 400,000 years, say, our weather has been pretty reliable. And what we're doing now is putting stress on all the foliage plants. So we're seeing whole types of trees start to die out in one region. Trees are something we can't do without. Trees provide oxygen. We don't know how to produce oxygen if we don't have any trees. And the president's report that came out last September on global climate change said very specifically, global climate change is happening. We have higher levels of carbon dioxide than we've had for the last 400,000 years. And one of the effects of this is on young trees, and it causes mortality, and it makes it hard for them to perform photosynthesis. Well, if we're killing our young trees, what are we going to breathe?
There are lungs.
They are our lungs, yes. So just watching my own garden, watching the trees on our property, has shown me alarming things about what's happening. And it's something you can't ignore if you're spending a lot of time outside. You start seeing things. You start seeing trees die and plants wither and struggle. And it's alarming.
Yeah. You know, when Sweetwater came to us here at WILL, it came with a piece of paper that described it as an environmental novel. And I thought, uh-oh. How do you balance, you know, your something that you're obviously passionate about with the need to take character and conflict and not lecture your reader?
Have you read it?
No.
Okay. It's a really good question, and it's one that I was worried about at the very beginning. It's a big problem, and you should never, I believe, as a writer, I should never write a polemic. I should never write a diatribe telling you what to do. So the book is like all my books. It's based on character and conflict, and the conflict has nothing to do, really, with the environment. It's about this woman who is married for the second time. She's been married for 7 months. She goes up to stay with her new husband and his family in the Adirondacks, and she realizes that she shouldn't have married him. And it's also, throughout the book, you have a long series of flashbacks about her first husband and her first marriage and what happened in that. And that's the drama and what happens in her new marriage. So these two parallel marriages are the drama. In the background are the Adirondacks, is the weather, is her sort of professional life. And I thought a lot about this problem, and of course nobody wants to write a political novel or an environmental novel. It's the fear of God. It's a dangerous thing to do.
Write a letter to the editor, not a novel, right?
Exactly. Yeah. So I thought about other writers who had done things like this, who had put in things that they cared about, and these were writers that I admired. And the two writers that I realized had done this, who were writers who were great heroes of mine, were Tolstoy and Virginia Woolf. And in Anna Karenina, the character of Levin, who represented Tolstoy's beliefs on this particular subject, is passionately obsessed with the notion of freeing the serfs. He is completely driven by this, and he's an aristocrat himself. He owns serfs, he owns a lot of property, but he believes the system is wrong, and he wants to stop it, to end it. So he's not the central character, of course, but he's an important character, and he's very lovable. And I realize that the way Tolstoy makes him lovable is making him obsessive about this, but not asking the reader to believe everything he says. And in our lives, we can't be zealous. If I come to your house for dinner, I can't hold forth about the environment. It would be rude and oppressive, and it would make me into a very bad guest. And so as a writer, you can't make your protagonist into somebody who's forcing the reader to believe something. So Levin makes a fool of himself periodically about this issue. He holds forth too long. He says ridiculous things. He can't stop himself. He knows he's being foolish, but he can't help it. So I liked that feeling that Tolstoy gives you of allowing the reader to separate herself from Levin and laugh at him at the same time that she finds him sympathetic, because he is struggling with an important issue, and you do feel sympathetic towards him, even as you want to say, Levin, shut up, stop, this is ridiculous, we're trying to have dinner here. And the other person who did this so beautifully is Virginia Woolf in To the Lighthouse, and if you remember the scene when they're all sitting around at dinner, all the house guests, all the children, Mrs. Ramsay and her husband. And Mrs. Ramsay starts talking about what she's done that day, and she's a very good person, Mrs. Ramsay. She visits the poor, she takes them food, she helps sick people. She's a wonderfully generous, philanthropic character. But as she sits there at dinner, she starts talking about the problem of tuberculosis in the local dairy. And this is something which is actually a very important subject in the late 19th century, when there were no vaccinations and tuberculosis was terribly dangerous. But as she starts to talk about it, all her children start looking at each other. There's this look that goes around the table, and they all start rolling their eyes and laughing into their napkins, because mom is...
There she goes again.
So, again, it was the same sense of distance and the same sense of relief for the reader, because you realize you don't have to agree with what the person is saying. Maybe right, you might agree with it, but you don't have to. It's not imposed on you. So I used that notion, and so Isabel, although she does hold forth once or twice, she gets in trouble, and the reader is allowed to look at her and say, Isabel, you shouldn't have done this. You just can't behave like this. She can't help herself any more than Levin can or Mrs. Ramsay, but that was sort of my model. Not that I am trying to compare myself to those writers, but that was the path that I followed in this.
Yeah. So when I read Sweetwater, I will probably from time to time go, oh, Isabel,
yes.
Isabel.
Yes. I wish you hadn't said that, Isabel. But you won't feel that you have to believe her.
I read The House of Mirth last summer, and I found myself going, Lily Bart.
Don't
do that. Stop.
Exactly. That's what you're meant to. I mean, all great fiction is peopled by characters with great flaws. And if the writer is strong enough, you feel yourself identifying with that character, and you think, I know what that's like. I've done that too. And you feel you can't believe that the character is going to do it, but you understand that position.
Well, Edith Wharton, here's another writer who's taken an issue that wants to talk about, and she's done it beautifully.
Well, really great fiction can be talked about on lots of different levels. You can say this is what the sociology is, and this is what the politics are in this book, and you can sort of take it apart and analyze it from whatever point of view you choose. And it's really great fiction is very complex and offers lots of different things to the reader.
Hmm. There we have to leave it. The time has flown by. You've been a great guest.
Thank you so much.
You're entirely welcome. Our guest this afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine has been Roxana Robinson. Her latest collection of short stories, A Perfect Stranger, and her novel, her latest novel, Sweetwater, is now out in paperback.
Agricultural programming on WILL is made possible by Farm Credit Services of Illinois. Farm Credit Services of Illinois has been providing for farmers' credit and insurance needs for over 85 years, including real estate, operating and machinery loans, crop and life insurance protection, and programs for young and beginning farmers.
You're tuned to the Afternoon Magazine. Let's find out what happened today on the Chicago Board of Trade here with the highs, lows, and settlement prices. Todd Gleason.
Thanks very much, Celeste, from the Chicago Board of Trade. A big update again today at the Board of Trade. Most of this technically led some fund buying, I'm supposed, going on. Buy stops on the way up hit. And then there was a speech that President Bush made today urging Congress to pass the energy bill. Speaking of that, Secretary of Agriculture Mike Johanns will be in Springfield, Illinois tomorrow at 10:45 a.m. at the Stone Seed Farm. You, the farmers, are all invited out to that farm. It's just outside of Springfield on Route 97. If you're headed to Petersburg, if you happen to know where that is, you'll know just about where to go. It's not too far outside of Springfield. Pretty easy to get to. Starts at 10:45. They'll have about a 45-minute conversation with the farmers there. Illinois Farm Bureau put the program together, but urged Dave, Dickey, and I to make sure that we told everybody that they're invited. If you'd like to see a map and other directions, we put that up on our website at WILL.UI. UC.edu. Just click on AM and then Agriculture. I will be in Springfield all day tomorrow. Look forward to seeing you tomorrow morning at 10:45 at the Stone Seed Farm to talk with Secretary Johanns. He will make a speech at 1 o'clock, actually 1:30, at the Illinois FFA Association State Convention as well. And then immediately after that, press availability just happens to coincide with the closing market report. So we'll have him about 2:20. To 2:30 tomorrow. They updated the times on us. We were thinking it might be 5 minutes earlier than that, but 2:20 to 2:30. We'll be talking to U.S. Secretary of Agriculture Mike Johanns live right here on the Closing Market Report from Springfield. Now, here are the numbers from the Chicago Board of Trade. Once again, just as a reminder, President Bush talking about the energy bill, urging Congress to pass it, and it did push prices higher today. July futures in the wheat pit, a 324 and three quarters high, low at 318 and a half. Settlement price there at $3.23. They were up 7. September's 334 and three quarters the high, the low at 328, settled 333, up 6 and three quarters. And December futures were up 7 and a quarter today, 344 and three quarters the settlement price, the high at 46 and a quarter and a low at 40 and one half. March wheat, 356 and a half at the Board of Trade with the high, the low at 351 and a half, and a settlement price at $3.55 and a half cents a bushel. They were up 7 and a half for the day. May futures, a 360 high, low at 357, settled 359 and a half, up 8.5. July corn now, 5.25 higher. That was kind of the tone for the rest of that grain pit for the day, up about a nickel. 5.25 higher in the July futures, $2.26 and three quarters the high, the low at 222 and one quarter, and a settlement price at $2.24 and a quarter cents. July futures in the corn pit up 5.25. September's 236, the high, the low at 231 and a quarter. Settlement price there, $2.33 and three quarters, up 5.5 cents. In December contract, 246 and a half, the high, the low at 242. Settlement price at 244 and a half, up 5.75. March futures in the corn pit, 253 and three quarters, the high, the low at 250. Settled at $2.52 and a quarter. They were up a nickel for the day in the May futures, up 5.5 cents for next year. 256 and a quarter, the high, the low at 253 and a half. The May 2006 corn contract settled at $2.55 and a half cents. They were up 5.5 cents. And July of next year, up 5.5 as well, with the high up 260, a low at 56 and three quarters, and a settlement price at $2.59 and one quarter. Oats July contract, 156 and three quarters, the high, the low at 153. July oats settled at $1.55 and a quarter. They were up 3 and one quarter. And the September contract up 3 and a quarter as well, 159 and three quarters the settlement price there. The high at 160, the low at 156 and one half. From the soy complex, nearby July beans, $7.05 the high today. The low at 696, settlement price at 689 and three quarters. They were up 12 and a quarter. August futures, 709 the high. The low at 6.99 and a settlement price at 6.93 1/4, up 12 3/4. And the September 7-Eleven, the high, the low at $7, settled 6.96 1/4, up 12 3/4. And the November futures, 7.22, the high, the low at 7.11, settled 7.04 3/4, up 15 3/4. January contract, 7.21 1/2, the high, the low at 7.11 1/2, and a settlement at 7.04 1/2, up 16 1/2. In the March soybeans, 7.07, the high, the low at 6.97, and a settlement price at, well, you know, all these settlement prices cannot be right. That's, none of them can be right, because simply all the lows are higher than any of the settlements on these bean prices. So we'll have to get back to those and figure out just exactly what's happening here. Let's see. I've got just a different set that's wrong. Let's try this again. We'll start with the July beans. Can you check those corn numbers and see if they were right for me, Dave? July beans, 7.02 1/2. The settlement price up 12 3/4 today. The high at 5 1/2, the low at 6.96. August futures, 7.09, the high, the low at 6.99. Settlement price at 7.06 1/2. They were up 13 1/4. In the September's, 7.11, the high, the low at $7. Settlement price at 7.09, up 12 3/4. In the November's, 7.22, the high, the low at 7.11. Settlement price at 7.20 3/4, up 16. And the Jan's, 7.21 1/2, the high, the low at 7.11 1/2, settled at $7.20 1/4. They were up 15 3/4. In the March contract, 7.07, the high, the low at 6.97. Settlement price at 7.06 1/2. They were up 15. And Dave Dickey tells me that all the corn numbers were right, so those came across right in the initial side of our printout, but the bean numbers were not. Now they are. Bean meal now. July futures, 225, the high, the low at 221.30. Settlement price at 223.90. They were up $3. And the August contract up 290, 224.50. The settlement price, 225.80. The high, the low at 222.10. Bean oil futures, July 24.29, the high, the low at 23.48. Settled 24.17. They were up 92. And the August oil, 23.32. Up $1.03 for the day. Now here's Celeste Quinn with the numbers from the Mercantile Exchange. Thanks, Celeste.
Okay, August feeder cattle, 109.20, the high, the low 108.40, the settlement 108.75, that down 50. September 108.10, the high 107.37 1/2, the low 107.82 1/2, the settlement that down 55. October 106.40, the high, the low 105.85, the settlement 106.20, that down 30. July live cattle, 83, oops, let's go backwards here. June live cattle is where I want to be. 82.62 1/2, the high, 81.82 1/2, the low, 81.90, the settlement, that down $1. August live cattle, 80.40, the high, 79.92 1/2, the low, the settlement, 80.20, that down 47 1/2. July lean hogs, 68.10, the high, 66.92 1/2, the low, 67.82 1/2, the settlement, that up 50. August, 66.60, the high, 65.35, the low, the settlement, 66.40, that up 42 1/2. October, 57.85, the high, 56.55, the low, 57.30, the settlement.